Welcome to Relatable 2.0. This is your host, Teresa Freeman. I speak with Karen Schaefer. Yep, she's back to talk to us about what she's been doing since her retirement from the CIA. We also talk about the current climate in Homeland Security, what it takes to stand out as a candidate, and how important doing your homework is. We also talk about the intricacies and what it's like to go through that clearance process. Lots to learn. Enjoy this episode and stay connected. We have some analytics that we look at for the podcast, and you're quite the fan favorite. Yeah, in terms of most listened, and sometimes that ebbs and flows, but recently you're sort of at the top of the list, and it got me thinking and reflecting about our conversation, and I really, you know, when we talked before, I felt like I knew it wasn't going to be the last time we spoke. I just had a feeling, or at least that I was going to come bug you again. But I just really appreciate you being open to chatting again.
Absolutely. And I have to say, I'm sure it was the clickbait when they saw the CIA affiliation. They probably listened, but I'm glad people did listen. And hopefully it was helpful to some folks in some small measure. So yeah, that's what we strive for, right?
Absolutely. And for people that are listening now that maybe didn't listen before, you know, we talked a lot about your journey and your path. And I think a couple of things that you talked about in that interview that were really helpful was just, you know, kind of entrance into the CIA and then what you got there. I know I got fairly technical about, like, I was really interested in sort of the how and the what of those types of roles. And so you talk about that in great detail, which I think is really helpful, and give a very, I think, practical and honest assessment of what it requires to get in and sort of be in that competitive landscape. And then obviously we talked about some cool experiences that you had. So people need to go back and listen if they haven't yet, because that was
Yeah, and it's always fun to reminisce. So it was great for me. And I would say to your listeners, if they didn't listen to the previous one, I offered, one of my passions is obviously getting young people into national security. And I think it is now more than ever, given the nature of the challenges, national security challenges, global challenges that we're all collectively facing. It's more important now than it ever has been for smart, talented young people to apply to all of the government agencies. I'm obviously ferociously biased about the agency, but I also, as you know, worked at FBI. So I often will steer young men and women that way or to other government agencies, depending on their talents and passions. So anyone who's interested, I'm on LinkedIn and I do quite a bit of a mentoring. So I offer that up.
I love that you brought that up first, because I think I do want to hear a bit more. I think we just started to scratch the surface about your transition. You probably have some interesting tips to share there just in your own journey. Given what you just said, though, it's interesting. I have a lot of clients that are just coming out of school and are looking for help around interview prep or looking for jobs. I also have clients that are in the transition space. So I'm lucky that I get to see people in all these different milestones. Interesting, though, when you mention national security and roles in national security and it being so important now, I'm curious how you would, maybe your perspective or how you could answer for people that are, because the political climate is so crazy, and not to get into a political conversation, but it's more about, I think, from what I'm hearing, and again, this is like layman, I'm not in your sphere, but what I hear is, like, dependent on the party, then it's when you should enter or not enter or be a part of national security. And my opinion, as being somewhat neutral to the whole thing, is, like, we always need people in national security, regardless of party. So is there a way to maybe you could talk about that?
Oh, I'd be happy to. You know, look, I know it's a really challenging climate right now. So I appreciate a lot of the confusion. I think we also have a crisis right now. I think there's a lot of cynicism about government service. And I would say that the government is quite candidly a reflection of the general population. We have a little bit of everything. We've got wonderful, talented people. We also occasionally do have some bad actors. Having said all of that, I think that I cannot emphasize enough, as someone who spent almost 30 years of my life, almost, you know, from the time I stepped out of college and essentially stepped right into a career in intelligence, that I was surrounded by the finest people, that their dedication and devotion was exclusively to the country. And I think something that is often lost in translation with a lot of the political hyperbole that's happening right now is the fact that most people who enter government service, they are not doing it because they think they're going to become rich or famous or any of the above. Most people who choose a career in government service choose it because, number one, they feel passionately about this country and what we stand for. I still do. I still look for ways to give back. I spend a lot of time, you and I talked about this, reaching out in particular to young women to encourage them to join the national security realm. I think that the people that I have met and worked side by side for decades with were absolutely motivated by a desire to ensure that this country and its democratic principles not only survive but thrive, and that we create a safe environment not only for this country but for our allies. And I would say that the notion that that is specific to one party or one administration is nonsense. Do people have political opinions? Of course they do. But I will tell you that I never knew the political affiliation of my colleagues. I worked with these people for decades, and I could not tell you who was a Republican or who was a Democrat. You know, it's certainly a much more heated environment, but I think most government agencies are focused on the mission, and that does not change. You are not serving a particular individual. You are swearing in every oath of office that we all take when we join government service. You are not swearing your allegiance to a particular person. You are swearing your allegiance to the country and to the office of the presidency. So it's really important for people to understand that for most government employees, particularly when I was in the field, your mission doesn't change. The threat, I try to remind people that the threat is not us. The threat is outside of the United States. And that the more that we can remind ourselves that there is more that unites us than divides us, is really important. And I would just say one last thing. Yeah. You know, mistakes, there are absolutely mistakes that can be made, and there are absolutely instances where there has been bias or there has, but as a rule, there is really an incredible effort on the part of all government agencies to divorce personal bias and to set up protocols, whether it's in analysis or operations, to ensure that there are multiple layers of review, multiple layers of supervision, so that not any one bad actor can typically completely skew the deck in favor of one political party or another. So as a whole, you know, if I could, frankly, there's probably no more important message in this podcast right now than if people could believe me when I say this, and that it is, if Donald Trump is elected president, all of the people in the government will show up and serve. If current President Biden is reelected, the folks in government office will show up and serve. The mission doesn't change. The threats posed by China, Russia, Iran, North Korea will not change. Those are the threats we should be focused on, not whether there is a, you know, a blue or a red administration.
It's so interesting as you're talking, because in my world, in the latter part of my career, I don't know if we talked about this before, but I was responsible for all employee investigations for one of the professional services firms that I worked for. Mm-hmm. And so in that role, I often worked with our Office of Security in investigating those situations. And because of the nature of my work, and I was also involved in a lot of risk mitigation, what was interesting is that because of the anchor of that work being objective, you know, mm-hmm. everything was to be objective. You were supposed to remain objective until you had enough information then to then make a recommendation or to make a call. And so it didn't, to your point, like it really didn't matter whose supervisor was who, or who, you know, who you were talking to as witnesses or any of that. What mattered was how do we get to like a fair and equitable outcome? And how do we make sure that we kind of understand what happened and then act accordingly? And so it's a very small kind of microcosm of what you're describing. But I think when you talk about the mission and being of service, and particularly in national security, mm-hmm. typically good and bad. And yes. So if you're rooted in serving as a patriot, as you've discussed, you know, I do think it can illuminate this topic a bit and help people understand that in a different way. And not, I think sometimes the political affiliation, it's like, it's a distraction, right? Than really right. just like, hey, you know, we need people that want to serve our country in this capacity. For those that, and I think we talked about this a little bit last time, but because you are now acting as a mentor, and I'm sure you mm-hmm. are getting a lot of people that are interested, and the CIA is competitive and the FBI is competitive to get in. Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about some ways that people can approach a career in, mm-hmm. in national security if they can't get there right now. So, you know, are there other avenues, are there other agencies you can talk about or other ways or just suggestions, mm-hmm. tips, right? For people that would want to do this, how can they?
Relatable 2.0 is sponsored by TFA Soft Skills, your one-stop shop for workshops, coaching, speaking, and soft skills development. If you'd like to hire Teresa or a member of her team, please visit tfasoftskills.com for more information. And if you'd like to advertise with Relatable 2.0, please email us at info@tfasoftskills.com. Now back to the show.
Yeah, as you mentioned, I talk to a lot of young people in particular. And I was mentioning to you earlier that I just spoke to a whole group of young women at the Yuma Center, 40 young girls from across the country that are all interested generally in national security in high school. And a couple of things that I would offer, I think for young people, because it can be very intimidating and very overwhelming, I would say a couple tips that I would give is internships are huge. Yeah. As a young person, when you're studying, particularly in college, there are a wealth of opportunities inside of the intelligence community, the national security apparatus. FBI has honors interns. The CIA has, you know, a program with, it's a 2-year process. Having said that, you got to apply early and you have to give yourself at least a year lead time to do internships that can prepare you. Because as I'm sure you're aware, Teresa, there is nothing better than an internship. Number one, for people to get to know you and for you to prove yourself as a young person, but equally important for you to assess the organization and decide, hey, you know, you get a vote in this, especially if it's something that you think you're going to do for a career. It's really important for you not just to read something, but to, whenever possible, actually have hands-on experience. I thought I might want to be an international lawyer in international, in international realm. And I did it for 6 months. I was a paralegal at a great law firm, Baker & Botts, one of the best, you know, and it took me 6 months to realize I was not lawyer material. Those kinds of experiences as a young person are incredibly important. So I would encourage people. And frankly, you know, my husband and I, who's a retired Navy captain, we have a daughter who is 17, and she was researching for high school. There are even opportunities for young people in high school. The FBI has this. She decided after doing a tour of the FBI that she wanted to be a special agent. She researched it. We said, well, honey, I think you're going to have to wait till college. And sure enough, she found an internship just by Googling. So I think opportunities like that, that build your appreciation and understanding of the community, are really important. As someone who might be a recent graduate, I always encourage people to apply if they're interested straight out of the gate. Usually I encourage them to apply while they're still in college. Having said that, most government agencies involved in the in national security do like to see some work experience. It's just a fact. Right. The beauty is that nowadays, so much of what the private sector does translates to the public sector. So, you know, for folks that are interested in jobs in the national security, you know, previous military experience is great, but that's not something everybody wants to do. So obviously, if you want to be in the military for a few years, and then that's always great bona fides. They have great leadership lessons, and it's a great opportunity. Sorry, my dog barks at everyone. Great opportunity to build leadership skills and just all around general life or job experience. But then there's also, you know, what we call the Beltway Bandits. There are all of these companies throughout the Washington, D.C. area that work with and contract with the federal government. All of these jobs require young, enthusiastic, energetic young people to fill jobs, everything from analysis to accounting to, you know, anything you can imagine, just about any skill set under the sun.
Those
companies work with different agencies. So you have the opportunity to work on these contracts as an, you know, in some capacity on the commercial side. There's also now all of these companies that do risk assessments and risk analysis, all sorts of companies out there that are working, you know, with what we call OSINT, open source intelligence. Mm-hmm. That, you know, if people are interested in the analytical world, they can, you know, try to explore different companies that are working in that realm. It gives you a chance to learn how to write, how to triage vast volumes of information, allows you to think critically and start to look analytically to discern disinformation and misinformation from the truth. So there are all sorts of opportunities. There's also a huge number of think tanks out here in the Washington, D.C. area that people can avail themselves of. They're always looking for interns. They're always looking for young people that are willing to do, you know, a lot of the time-consuming labor that goes into assessments and evaluations and report intelligence reports that they produce for their particular nonprofits that they've set up. So I think that's a long answer, but I think, you know, I would say, and the beauty is, unlike when you and I were growing up, Teresa, where you just had to hope you ran into someone who did what you wanted to do. Nowadays, the internet is a beautiful thing, and it can give you, you know, USA dot, what is it, Jobs USA or USA Jobs, I can't remember, always has every possible organization inside the federal government listing every possible job. So there's just a voluminous amount of opportunities out there. I think you just have to figure out how to search for or narrow down what you're more interested in, and then start to do some homework online to identify opportunities.
If you're a college graduate and there are some internships out there, would you recommend, if that's what's open, take it, even though you've already graduated?
Yes, but not every, right. I always think it's a great opportunity because, as you know, having that face-to-face contact, that access, is there's nothing comparable to that. Having said that, I'm also realistic enough, you know, I grew up in a lower middle income family. My parents were like, you're not taking a summer job that doesn't pay you. So, you know, I work multiple jobs. I get it. So that's not an option to everyone. But the other thing that, you know, that is potentially an option is that, you know, you can affiliate yourself with different communities out there. You know, there's different organizations. I think I've mentioned to you, I'm part, for example, of the Cypher Group, which is, you know, this organization of former intelligence officers, and they all get together and wax philosophically about the topic national security challenge du jour. And, but it's a, you know, there are different organizations that host different events where people will come and speak and you can learn about, you know, hosted by journalists or by organizations that by embassies. I mean, there's so much activity constant churn happening in the DC area that I think if young people are looking for those kinds of opportunities to stay current, but also look, life is, you know, luck is, you know, luck is what you make of it, right? It is
really being intersection of like, isn't it? Like, luck is the intersection of like hard work and opportunity or something.
Opportunity. Right. Yeah. So some of that hard work is showing up and just getting smart on something and hoping that you could, you know, talk to someone who maybe was one of the speakers and ask to speak to them about what their career has been like and would they be willing to mentor you. So there's all sorts of opportunities like that that I think people, much more so in this area in particular, you'd be hard pressed to be anywhere that's more, has more people that are available to serve as sort of mentors or sponsors as you look to build out a career in whatever particular segment of the national security apparatus you might be interested in.
I think you raise a good point too around there are so many smaller companies now, small to mid-sized companies that are contracting with these agencies. So you could still be connected to the work, still gets exposure to the work, build some qualifications. And then there's a lot of people that I think they call it like rebadging, right? But once they have an experience, then they can come over. So I think there's not only one way to get there. And I also really like what you said about the homework, because I say the same thing, like regardless of whether it's national security or any person that any stage of your career, really do your homework, like figure out where are the people hanging out that you want to be with, you know, where are their open events? Like there's a lot available. You have to take the initiative to look into it, talk to people, put yourself out there. You know, one of my big mantras right now, it's like, don't be afraid to connect with people and ask them, you know, ask questions.
I have people cold contact me over LinkedIn, and I, you know, assuming my schedule permits, I almost always am responsive to that because I think it takes a lot of chutzpah. We're looking for people with chutzpah. It shows me that they've done their homework and started to look for people in the community that do the kinds of things they're interested in doing. And yeah, I think you're exactly right. I also, you know, the one other advantage, I will go back just super quick because it occurred to me when you were talking on working for a lot of these Beltway Bandits or other companies, is the added bonus of that is not only do you get to sometimes work with the actual organizations that you might be interested in working with or working for, is that oftentimes if you're on a classified contract, you necessarily have to have a clearance. So these companies will sponsor you for clearances. And if people don't know this, the toughest hurdle for most people who apply to the intelligence community is getting through the whole vetting process and security and investigation process for the community, regardless of what organization. It is a long haul. It is time consuming. It can be very emotionally draining. And so when you come in and you've already been validated and already been cleared to, in particular, if you've got a top secret SCI clearance, which is sort of the holy grail of clearances, then God bless you. You are already going to have an awesome check next to your name that's going to be a differentiator for you.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit, because I don't think we talked about this last time. Tell me a little bit about that process of going through and the things that people should kind of be aware of to get through it. Or, you know, it used to be, I remember back in the day, like, you can't smoke pot because that'll show up in the, you know, like, so that's, there's like a very, you know, kind of minute thing. But to your point about it being emotional, like, what is it that kind of makes it that way? Or what are the hoops that people have to go through?
Right. Well, I'm happy to say that it's not as arduous as it used to be. Thankfully, you know, the DNI has done some pretty significant work working with the community to work on a lot of the backlogs. A lot of the HR departments have also gotten much smarter about anticipating vacancies and how many people they need to hire, et cetera. So there isn't as much of a backlog, but the average process for an application is still anywhere from a year to 18 months. So it's an extraordinarily long period of time. And going back to the point that I made earlier, not everybody has the luxury of just sitting around and waiting for a year, year and a half. And frankly, we do lose very good qualified candidates because we can't always process them quickly enough so that they will be still unemployed by the time we offer them, you know, an opportunity to work with our particular agency. So it's still a long process, but much better. I think a couple of things I always tell young people who are applying. Number one, you know, work experience is always helpful. So while you're looking for a job, get a job, right?
Yep,
so have a job, right? You know, have a job while you're looking for your ideal job. Stay current. Make sure that you understand what's happening in the world. Be prepared to receive a call. You know, the minute you drop an application, be prepared for a phone interview so that you can speak intelligently about the world and be prepared for an interview. It may not come for several months, but it might come within a couple of weeks. And if you're caught flat-footed, so many people are not properly prepared. So I always remind people, you know, you graduate from college, you no longer have your mandatory reading. So now you have to, you know, you have to have the discipline to stay current on what's happening in the world around you. I always tell people, and this goes back to doing your homework, you know, you want to make sure you understand what you, you know, if you catch the bus, like you want to know if you're the dog that catches the bus, that you understand what it is that you're actually applying for. And the best way to do that is, number one, go on forward facing or outward facing website. Every single government agency now has a website where they will literally explain in excruciating detail the different career opportunities, but they'll also describe the mission and all the different ways you can serve. I mean, at the agency, everybody understands the Jason Bourne role, or they think they understand the operations officer. But we literally have makeup artists who work with disguise. We have, you know, seamstresses who also work in disguise. We have accountants. We have, you know, it is this entire ecosystem that supports the mission of the agency. It's, you know, everything under the sun that you can think of it. And there's an opportunity to do that essentially under the umbrella of the CIA. So doing research on those websites. The other thing that most of these organizations do now is they have these, CIA even launched their own podcast. So listen to the podcast.
Oh, yeah.
Hear people who are actual practitioners talking about what they do. Also, there are always recommended reading. Do that. Make sure that you're smart about what you're stepping into and that you can speak intelligently. So that's the basic homework preparation. And then there's just the lifestyle piece. Like, you want a top secret clearance. It is an honor and a privilege. You know, I remind people all the time, it was an honor and a privilege to serve my country for 26 years. And I had to earn that. And what I mean by that is there are things that they will require of you that are not always comfortable. I mean, you have to pass a, you know, a polygraph. They are not, you know, they are going to do research on you and every, all, you know, your sort of network, your professional contacts, your personal contacts, your family, to make sure that you're not a counterintelligence threat, because there are plenty of people applying to the agency who are not patriotic and quite the contrary, have been tasked to apply in order to infiltrate the agency. So they are going to do a really robust background investigation. You know, none of us are perfect. We've all had things that we've done in our past that we're probably not proud of. I remember my first polygraph. I'm, you know, I'm about half an hour into it, and the guy says to me, "Are you Catholic?" And I said, he's like, "Okay, stop." And he said, "I don't want to know if you took, you know, a pencil from your, you know, your best friend's desk when you were in kindergarten." But I was so there is a lot of scrutiny, and it's something that you have to acclimate yourself to. I'm here to tell you, it never, I religiously was polygraphed because I was an operations officer, and every time I would come back from an assignment, you know, sort of like the clock would go off and I'd have my polygraph. So, you know, it is, there are things that you are going to be subjected to that are not always comfortable. I tell people, don't get into trouble with the law. Try to avoid drugs, try to avoid, you know, underage drinking, try to, you know, I mean, I'm also cognizant. I was a teenager. I was in college. I certainly was not above reproach. So I, you know, there is a recognition that there's some things in life that just happen. So the biggest key to getting through that process is being absolutely categorically honest about anything that you think might be a hindrance. A lot of people do worry, particularly people that are first generation who come from countries like Iran and China and other places. It is not a showstopper. The process can be a little lengthier. And a lot of the scrutiny is to ensure the safety, not just of the applicant, but also their families if they were to join the organization. But you know, these are things people need to understand, that, you know, you do, you know, you go through this process, but I would argue that at the end of the day, you get much more in return, because you are then afforded an opportunity to have access to the most sensitive information that the U.S. government has in order to inform policymakers and hopefully, you know, drive forward.
Is there a physical component? Like, if people think, you know, I know with the FBI, there's more of like, you know, they've got to be able to run them, you know, run a mile.
Yeah.
So for CIA, is there that kind of,
We do have the whole training program is about a year and a half, and they do have a segment that is, it is more about preparing for high threat, to, you know, sort of familiarizing you with the military for escape and evacuation, that sort of thing, in the event of, you know, coups or things like that, just to sensitize you to all of those requirements. But there's, and we have extraordinary training for folks that go to high threat environments. I think I told you my first tour was in, at the time, the highest threat post in the world. And I was someone who had gone to the University of Virginia, graduated from Fairfax High School. I had no military background. I had no skills. I was not a quote unquote operative. And I'm happy to say that after that year and a half, you know, you do a lot of work at headquarters to understand the organization, the mission, et cetera. And then you have your actual tradecraft training that teaches you the craft of how to recruit well-placed individuals who can provide clandestine information. And then on top of that, so that can be upwards of a year and a half. Then you can have, if you're going to a country and you don't speak that language, you can have language training, which is an additional year. And then if it's a high threat post, you oftentimes have additional tradecraft training, but also additional security training. Everyone who would go to the war zone would have firearms training, defensive driving training, self-protection. So, you know, what I am happy to say is that the organization invests an incredible amount of time and energy into its people to develop them. So, you know, certainly I was nervous when I did my first operational act in my first tour, but I felt prepared. And in fact, I was prepared because the training had been exceptional and the mentorship was exceptional.
Does that mean they're, that's so interesting to me. Like, does that mean they're planning 2 years out? Because some things are more immediate, right? But for you, for like a start class, I can imagine, just like, again, I translate to normal, like outside the national security world, like you have a start class, people get trained in a certain way, and then they're sort of farmed out based on their specialty, right? So similarly, right. I'm guessing if it would for you, because you started right outside of school, there's a start class, and then they say, okay, the next 2 years, we're going to train and develop and then deploy.
Yep, that's correct. Yeah. And there's every year there's a new bid list that comes, you know, much like State Department, our process is very similar where openings come, you know, once you're inside the organization, then you'll have essentially what's called a bid list of opportunities, positions that are available globally that everybody will bid on. So it's a great opportunity. I will simply make my plug that it is such an incredible organization in that every couple of years you get to completely reinvent yourself. Some people would say upend your life. I argue that it's change is a healthy thing, and it's certainly a great adventure. Every couple of years, you have this opportunity to serve in a new country, potentially in a new continent, learn a new language if you'd like. I have friends who have learned three languages working at the agency, and it's a pretty incredible opportunity for anyone who has that sense of an adventure and is intellectually curious.
How, so that's like, it's a good point for us to ask, given that how's the transition been? Because when we talked, it was pretty new. And so some time now, and do you miss it? Have you like, I'll just ask that first, like, or what do you miss about it? And then we can talk about kind of the cool things you're doing.
Teresa's book, Soft Skills I Learned the Hard Way, is available for purchase on our website at tfasoftskills.com or on Amazon. She writes about her epic fails throughout her career and how she learned from them so you don't have to. This book is filled with cheat codes on how you can differentiate yourself when it matters, like in an interview, trying to get that promotion, or being a first-time leader. As always, thank you to our Relatable 2.0 community.
Right. So I think it sounds very cliche because it's true. I do miss the mission and I do miss the people. And I knew that that was going to be the case stepping out. And so I think I may have mentioned this to you before. It was very important to me. And I was fortunate enough that I had an awesome coach inside at the time. She was inside the building. And, you know, she said, you know, you have to be thoughtful about how you want to stay connected, because there's also a level that can be unhealthy, I believe. If you can't leave sort of, because you're never going to go, you really can't go home again, right? And in our case, it's really odd because it's not like I can just call up my friends at the agency and say, hey, I'm going to come over for lunch. You know, you walk out of that building, you turn in your badge, and you no longer have access. So it is a very abrupt sort of, I went from a job where I was literally, I joke that, you know, I was reading the PDB and briefing or discussing it with, you know, the senior leaders at the FBI one day, to getting my intel updates from Al Roker. So it's a bit of a shock to the system, right? So, what I did is I was pretty deliberate in my efforts to stay connected to the community that I wanted to stay connected to. And so the way that I chose to do that, there's lots of, you know, folks do all sorts of different things. As you mentioned, some people go back and work contract, green badge, you know, they go from blue badge, which is a staff person, to green badge, which is a contractor. And that is scratches their itch and allows them to continue to do what they love in the way that they want to do it. I wanted to stay connected to national security, but I really wanted to do it in a way that allowed me much more personal time with my family. I think I told you the last time the driver for me was having the opportunity, you know, I rarely saw my five-year-old, and, you know, it was a struggle. And I have two stepchildren that are in Florida, and it just, everything was hard. And so for me, it was a great decision to step out. And I quickly realized that I wanted to have a schedule that didn't require a full-time job. So I chose to go the board route, which I may have overachieved in the sense that
everybody wants a piece.
Yes, you and I talked a little bit about this, but I found that it was hard to say no at first. And I mentioned this to you, and I'll just mention it to other people. I got this advice, but I didn't listen to it, that the opportunities will come. You should just be patient and know your value and know your worth. And I think I've gotten much better at that. And so I'm currently working. Everything is still sort of wrapped around the national security rubric. So I categorize my efforts in terms of nonprofit boards. I'm currently serving on several nonprofits. One is Third Option, which is an organization that raises money and provides support to our agency officers who have been killed or wounded in action. I'm on the board of a company or a nonprofit called FAMIL, which is it was established by this amazing young woman that is a former agency officer, and she. After the fall of Afghanistan, she created the nonprofit to support all of our Afghan partners who had been brought to the United States, and it's helping them regularize their status here inside the United States. So I'm on that board. I'm also, I'm not sure I was at the time on this board, but it's a newer one for me, which is part of the Secure Community Network. And this is advisory board for the Secure Community Network. And that's an organization that provides security, threat analysis, threat reporting for the Jewish community inside the United States. And given the heightened the rise in anti-Semitic rhetoric as well as threats, it has been really a surprisingly rewarding position and an opportunity to focus on something that I think is so important. I'm on that one as well. I'm on the Spy Museum board, which is advisory board, excuse me, not the board itself. And then I'm also a member of the Cipher Brief, which is an organization of former intelligence officers that I alluded to before that sit around and discuss. Don't sit around.
Those have got to be interesting conversations, for sure.
They are. Podcasts, and then the Cipher Brief. The folks write probably, I think, the most informed pieces on current events in the national security realm, everything from the impact of artificial intelligence to cyber attacks to, you know, the latest Russian aggression in Ukraine. So it's a pretty extraordinary organization. And I'm hoping to join, I have an interview actually later today for another board supporting military members transitions from active duty to the private sector, which something that I am very passionate about because of the increasing numbers of military officers and enlisted taking their own lives because they don't see a path forward post Iraq and Afghanistan. So that's the way I've chosen it in terms of the boards. I'm on a couple of paid boards as well. And then I mentioned to you before, I do a lot of the mentoring with young people who are interested in joining the community, but then also folks who are transitioning out of the intelligence community and trying to figure out how do they leverage all the soft skills that they've developed in the context of the intelligence world into what I call private sector speak, so that it resonates with people and they understand that these people come with a set of special, to invoke Liam Neeson in Taken, I have a set of special skills, right? So I think it's been a great transition for me, and I'm getting smarter every day where I know that where I'm able to discern that I can have the greatest impact.
Mm-hmm. And how does it feel? I think on the flip side too, to be able to, now your 5-year-old is 8.
He's 9. Yep. He's going to be turning.
You've been able to be there in a different way. Oh. How has that been?
It's incredible. I can honestly say I have no regrets. Everybody's journey is different. I'm not sure I would recommend to a young woman starting out that she wait until she's 40 to meet her future husband, wait till she's 42 to get married, or 45 to have a child. But, part of that was the circumstances, a lot happening in the world and a lot of the churn post 9/11. And so I think it was what was good for me. And I spend a lot of time in particular talking to young women when I talk about the challenges of work-life balance. And I do have to give a shout out to my husband because I mentioned that I had spoken to this young group of young women. And yesterday they were asking me what was the most important thing that I believed was important to my career, my successful career. And I did say, I think for any woman trying to have a career in a very very demanding environment, private sector, public sector, doesn't matter. It's choosing the right partner, life partner. And, I think it is absolutely true, because if you don't have someone who values your career as much as they value theirs, if you can't learn to compromise, give and take is fine, but it can't always be that you're the one giving and they're taking. And so having that partner who, as I said, he was really Mr. Mom for those first 5 years. I was stuck in a skiff and most of the time showing up late for daycare. So spending $25 a minute.
We say that all the time. We have 3 boys and we talk a lot about finding that partner and how, like, my husband will say, and I think it's better in a way coming from him than me, because maybe there's a bias with the mom, like, oh, mom, but he'll say all the time, like, that is the most important decision you're ever going to make. Like, regardless of your job, regardless of, where you live, yes. It's like that person, if you really want that kind of, you want a life of with a partner and a companion and the whole thing, like picking that person and really evaluating that. And I think it's so interesting, like if I hear like really young, like 20s, early 20s, I'm like getting married, I'm like, oh my gosh, because I feel like that so much of your 20s, like really figuring out who you are, and the frontal lobe is still developing till 25. Right. And I just think that it is such an important life choice. And I think for women, I remember being in my late 20s, like everybody's getting married. So then there was all this pressure to get married. And it was like, thankfully, the person I was with ended up being my person and it kind of worked out. But that pressure to be married pushes a lot of people into those decisions. And you don't really, when you're like, oh, I just want to be married. And I want that like idea of what marriage, how it's portrayed out in movies and books and whatever. You don't really really understand the long haul that is that choice, if that's in fact, how you want to go about it. So, we're at like almost 20, we're at 25 or 23 or whatever. And it's like you really see it is such a long journey. And you really
And
have
then,
to pick an approach.
right, and then you throw in children and forget it. I mean, I don't think it, no matter how much you can talk to someone about the level of responsibility that comes with children, none of it accurately defines what it's like to have children and how that affects your career. And I think I say this as someone who would never ever make different choices than what I've made, but I will say that, I think one of the things that we've done is a disservice to young people is this idea, not qualifying this notion of having it all, right? Is it because they're really, truly, you can't have it all at the same time. You simply cannot. And it's a bit of what drives me crazy when people like Sheryl Sandberg say, lean in. It's like, really? You say that and you have a staff around you that helped raise your children, coordinate your life for you. Most of us do not have that. And so we have to be a lot more realistic. I was able I'm very, very clear-eyed about the fact that I was able to sprint the first half of my career because I was entirely unencumbered as a woman. And that is unusual.
Absolutely. And I think it's so fair to say that in terms of, the whole idea of you can have it all and you can't. And there's always trade-offs. There's always trade-offs. There's trade-offs if you choose to not have kids and be encumbered, because yes, you may be soaring on the career side, but you may be having some feelings of doubt or concern that you're losing out on that kind of life, right? So it just like even when you're successful and it feels good, there's trade-offs. And so I think you're right. I think we have done a disservice, and I think the more we can educate and just give real life examples of how it can work, like and you yourself knowing when you can like pull back and accelerate and pull, and being able to make those calls. It's hard for
But
sure.
also, and I'm sure you've experienced this, Teresa. You probably, given the success that you had in your work in the private sector, you were surrounded by a lot of very powerful, talented women who had really excelled in their field, as did I. And yet, I can tell you that just about every woman I have met to a one felt like somehow they came up short, because we have set this we've set this standard as if it were actually achievable that you are, you have to look like a supermodel, you have to be nice, you have to be strong, but not too strong. You have to be competent, but not so competent that you intimidate other people. You have to be a super mom. You've got to be the per, you know, so you've got to make cupcakes for the school bake sale while you're on your board meet. I mean, so there's just the list of never-ending requirements of all of the ways in which you are supposed to be exceptional. And so, and you're surrounded, and this is, part of the social media impact, is you're surrounded by all of these images of women who seem to have pulled it off. And I know I was one of those women that I was like, oh my God, I'm literally in my kitchen crying as my 6-month-old is throwing up on me. And I just burst into tears knowing I'm going to have the flu the next week and, miss work. It's just, so I was certainly that person that always felt like wherever I was, I should be somewhere else. And that's just that's an untenable paradigm for, not just women, but men. I mean, it's similar, and I think one of the interesting things for me is how much the fight for women to find some sort of work-life balance has actually benefited men as well. Like, I know so many men that are thrilled that they can finally step out at a reasonable hour and go coach their kids' soccer team as opposed to having to stay at work to show they're dedicated till 7 o'clock at night, right? I mean, we've created this notion that is not, I don't think it's achievable.
I remember, I think it was my youngest, maybe, and I knew the kindergarten teacher really well, and she begged me to be the room parent. And this is when I was full on in, you know, just traveling all the time and just really long, you know, two phones and the whole thing, the bat phone and the whole thing. And I just felt such guilt because I had never done the mom parent, the room parent thing. And mm-hmm. I always that push pull of like, you know, I'm giving so much here. Am I not giving enough here? And so I said I would do it. Also knowing that it's really not my strength. You know, I just was like, I knew the teacher. I wanted to help her out. I wanted to do a solid. I got fired halfway through the year.
I didn't get fired, but I did almost resign. So I think we can share more stories.
And I do remember, this is so, I vividly remember the first meeting of like this room mom thing. And I was with these other women. I felt so out of place. I was like the inefficiency of the meeting drove me crazy. I was like, mm-hmm. We've just wasted 3 hours. We could have done this in a half an hour. Like all the things, you know, and it just was like screaming at me, like, this is maybe not the highest and best use of your time. You love and show love to your kid in all these other ways. Like you're yep. providing for your family. You're, you know, and this idea of like figuring out, like, instead of like trying to do with all, like, what are the right. ways, and you even said it earlier about how you're applying your decisions now. It's like, where's the best value right. for you yes. with all of it? And like, where right. do you get the most impact? And you do have, and you have to make some trade-offs. Like, but it was like fired / resign. It was the right thing. Cause I was not serving that community very well. Right. I was trying to be, you know, like,
yeah. Yeah, it's just neither you nor I had the temperament.
wasn't a good match. Yeah,
but I think that point can't be overstated yeah. enough with yeah. finding your value, and part of that is, as you said, you know, I mean, there's a million and one things we could all do, but there's probably not a million and one things we should be all doing, and so. The luxury, I mean, you know, for all of you out there that might be transitioning, I think the beautiful thing about transition is that it does give you an opportunity, you know, certainly as a government employee, I did have a certain amount of latitude in terms of where I went and what I did, but a lot of it was at the, you know, direction of the, yeah. yeah, the mission drove where I served and what I did. The beauty now, and I think it's a luxury for all of us who step into a second career, is you take all of the lessons learned from that first career and you say, okay, now let me figure out, you know, where can I really make the biggest difference and where I also will be the happiest. And I think that's, if folks have that opportunity, it's pretty amazing. And it doesn't mean working for a lot of people. I have a, you know, one of my dearest friends retired to Maine, and she is up there. She's doing voting drives and she is in, you know, hiking clubs, and, you know, it's different for everybody, but I think figuring out what is going to bring you the greatest joy and where you can contribute the most effectively becomes really important.
Yes. And I think there's a piece of this too, which applies to those that are transitioning. And I, you know, it's a bit of a cliff. And so you don't know what you don't know.
Right.
And you have to be a little comfortable in that.
Mm-hmm.
And just, you know, hopefully from the two of us talking about it, but also the more people, other, you know, those in transition talk to, good things come, good things happen. There's other ways in which you can be in the world that are gratifying and fulfilling. And I think when you've done something for so long a certain way, you start to feel like there's only one way, you know?
Right. So, yeah, I think that's right. But I also, you know, and you, I think there's not just, there's, I had real fear. I thought, you know, I may have been accomplished in this public sector, but this is all new to me. And what if people don't want me? What if my skills don't translate? Now, again, I was fortunate enough that I had, like I said, a great coach that helped me think through, okay, what does this environment look like? And it's really not so different than what you're coming from. It's how you explain what you did and how you did it that really changes. And I think telling people that it's okay to be nervous, but not to have a level of patience that candidly, I'm not sure I really had initially. As mentioned, I probably jumped into too much too soon, but I do think it's important. And I think even if you don't recognize it, as your transition moves along, you get smarter. And so then you are able to start calling and start saying, okay. And I know that at some point, this will be something we discuss, but I think for most folks, this, and certainly for me, the hardest thing, I remember when my coach said to me, so what are you going to charge people if you're a consultant? And I had this just complete adrenaline rush and panic, because it's like, you know, I'm the person that hated writing my own performance evaluation, you know, and I'm thinking, oh my God, I have to tell people how much I'm worth. I have to actually ask them for money to pay me. And it was a really uncomfortable position to be in. And that's why I spend so much time now with people when they're transitioning saying, no, no, really, this is how much you're worth. And trust me, people will pay you this much. This is how much it costs, you know, the average company, if you're serving on a board, this is what you should ask for. And I try to do that because I remember my experience and how nervous I was. And I didn't feel like I had many people to help inform me about that sort of thing.
Yes. And we will talk about that. We're going to, we'll tease that for the next time we talk. But one thing I will say about that too, that really helped me with this and my same thing for me leaving and having to charge people. It was horrible, but someone said something to me. I'm like, okay, this helps me. It's like, no, you have 30 years that you did something, that you gained experience and expertise and have a unique set of skills and knowledge that other organizations, people, communities need and want. And that is a valued commodity. And so it's not just like a rate per hour. You're paying for those 30 years. And that is a unique thing that you have. A lot of us have at this stage where we're trying to do the second act. And so that helped me a lot. It was like, oh, that's right. Like, I'm not just somebody who's just starting, because you're starting something new. So you get mind tricked that it's like, no, you have this behind you and it's going to set you up. Yeah.
Yes. Agreed.
All right. Well, I have taken up so much of your time and I just feel like I'm greedy about it, but I so appreciate it. I love talking to you. It's so, you give me a lot to think about and I feel like you gave great information for both people entering and then also transitioning. So it's, you know, really helpful to kind of the whole community of listeners. And then yes, we will talk again soon. As I sort of frame this,
anytime.
Yeah,
it's always fun. I always enjoy our conversations, and I'll look forward to chatting with you again soon.
That sounds good. Thank you, Karen. Can't wait to talk to you again soon on our upcoming series, Know Your Worth, where we will learn a lot about your hot takes on where are the gaps in that space, as well as what are some best practices to handling them. Thank you for listening, Relatable community. As always, please rate, subscribe, and comment. Until next time, this is Teresa Freeman with Relatable 2.0. Stay connected.